2 years in any kind of new area or phenomena is very, very early. You know, so we're still, it's almost like thinking like we're still kind of like in the amoeba puddle pool, you know, like evolving very, very early on in this stuff. And there's a lot of new things that are going on. There's a lot of things that are being tried and they're failing. And there's a couple of things that are really taking hold. And I actually think it's a tremendously exciting time. And we shouldn't, you know, the expectation shouldn't be that we're going to be on the moon tomorrow.
And a lot of real criticism coming from some of the biggest proponents of this. Ellen Miller last week, pretty sharp. Sharp criticisms of where open government stands so far.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to be careful here. I actually think, particularly this administration in the United States, has done an enormous amount. They are wrestling with how to shift a public service that is not worked this way into a mode of thinking about Gov 2.0, about thinking about open government in some pretty serious ways. And I think they've made enormous strides. So I actually think that being critical in year two is not, I don't think that was particularly constructive. I do think that there are some things that people could be doing better, and we need to point those out. But I also think we need to reward them for the things that they have done that have been effective, and to kind of celebrate that and show citizens, you know, explain to them the accomplishments that have been made so people can get excited about those and encourage still more.
So give us some of the things that are working and some of the things that aren't.
Here's one place where we're having kind of a clash of cultures between kind of maybe like the startup culture of San Francisco clashing with the Washington, D.C. culture of the Beltway. You know, in San Francisco, you know, you're not really seen as someone who's viable or worth investing until at least you have one or two failed companies under your belt. Whereas, you know, a failure in Washington is often seen as, you know, for some people as a career killer.
Yeah. No, we bludgeon them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, so here, you know, when I look at something like challenge.gov, it is so radically different from what many governments have ever endeavored or tried to do. And, you know, is it going to succeed? I don't know. I think it's, you know, my colleagues in Canada and over the pond who look at that, they're blown away. They say, wow, this is something that's so different for government. They can't even believe it's being tried. And so I think the risks are quite high, and that needs to be acknowledged and rewarded. So we have a little bit of a clash where, you know, I think the Washington, D.C. people feel, hey, you know, we're actually coming a fair bit of a ways here, and the San Francisco people are saying, wait a minute, this isn't nearly as far as, you know, as we do on a day-to-day basis. And we're going to have to find some common ground and really recognize the successes. And I think the open government data portals, which, you know, some of which have really come a long way, are a great place to start. There's a lot more that could be done, but there's been other successes too.
And I look at how data.gov, how it has been emulated really around the world. That to me says something that either we're all lemmings and we all just follow along to me. But I think it actually says, hold on, there's something here. There's something about making this data available and almost the mindset that we have to make it available from the start. Thinking about that this is going to be made available is even a big step in and of itself.
Well, this is another thing which I think is a little bit unfair. You know, you need to look at this in an international context as well. And the things that have happened in the U.S. in the last 2 years have triggered a global revolution. You know, in Canada, in the United Kingdom, even in countries like Germany and France, you know, people are thinking about open government and Gov 2.0 in a way that, you know, that wasn't happening 2 years ago. And many people are working very hard to emulate kind of data.gov. So the U.K. has data.gov.uk. which, you know, I think actually has more data sets now than the U.S. government, so they've worked very, very hard. Their conservative coalition has taken kind of a labor stand on open data and taken it even further. So now you have it working on both sides of the spectrum. So here you kind of triggered an international revolution, and yet there's no acknowledgement of that fact as well. And people working internationally haven't superseded the United States. They haven't blown by them. So everybody's running into the same types of challenges, and they're all working very hard on it. And I think it's tapping into some deeper understanding that government needs to be open to people. And that's not just true in the United States. That feeling is felt around the world.
And it seems to me that part of what we're learning here is the things that if this is really going to take hold, this has to help government do its job better, or else it just becomes another mandate that I have to meet. And everyone has a lot of mandates on their plate, goodness knows. If this is really going to, it seems to me, really become part of almost the genetics of government, it really has to help you do your job better, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly been a big part of what I write about and some of the consulting work that I do, which is We need to build open data portals because we want citizens to have access to government data. But, you know, I've long said that the biggest users of open data aren't going to be citizens. They're going to be government employees. That for too long, the people who work in government and who try to work to serve us have been siloed or just have never been allowed to have access to the information that government itself creates.
Yeah.
You know, you had to sit through 5 meetings with 20 different people from other ministries who would then consider your request to get access to this data. And so what I love about open data and getting it available for citizens is that when you architect a system that makes this information available to, you know, people like you and me, you have by default architected the system to make it available to government officials.
Yeah. And I think if I had one criticism, and it's not even a criticism, it's more where I'd urge the administration to push a little farther is have OMB should have, frankly, the best open government plan anywhere in government. It is other federal agencies that are going to use this data. They know how to find it. They know how to use it. That will be, I think, more powerful than anything. And at least here in the U.S., you're up in Canada, but here in the U.S., we have this fantasy called pre-decisional documents. And things where it's a little bit like Emperor's New Clothes. We're all supposed to walk around and pretend like, oh, that information isn't actually been blessed, I guess, by the president or by God or whomever. Make that available, and wow, I think really magical things could happen.
Yeah, there's kind of a couple of metrics that I think we need to be using. You know, right now when people talk about open government or open data, that the kind of the magical measurement of success is, did some developer out there create an application? And if they did that, then, you know, it was all worthwhile, or that's what success looks like. And I actually think that is a very narrow definition of success, and it's going to account for a very small percentage of how open data gets used. It's great when people create applications. I'm very excited about that. But I have to be honest, I get even more excited when people are using that data to do their own analysis or make their own public policy suggestions.
Yeah.
So people are just using it to write up ideas, and you know, we've had that happen in Vancouver. I've seen that happen in other cities. But where I'm really going to get excited is when people inside government start using this data to write their own reports or to actually shape public policy.
Yeah.
And then where I think the real opportunity is going to be, and this is kind of the final metric, is when developers within government or vendors who are selling software to government start using data from the open data streams to better serve and create applications that are used inside government. Mm. Because now it's no longer doing open data for compliance or to serve citizens. It's actually that it's enabling you to buy software much, much more cheaply.
I want to ask you, because you just did a really, I think, marvelous post on something called Civic Commons, and we're going to talk to the Civic Commons folks. But talk to me about Civic Commons, what it is, and why this is important, because you think it's a pretty big step.
Yeah, so, you know, let me explain to you a little bit from my context, which is a little over a year and a half ago, up here in Vancouver, City Council passed a motion, what we call Open 3, which called for open data, the use of open standards, and the application of the open source license to any software created by the city, and to put open source software on an equal footing as proprietary software in the procurement cycle. And, you know, everybody's focused on the first two. Vancouver has a pretty decent open data portal, and there's a lot of open standards that are used on it. But, you know, nobody really talks about the open source piece. And I was giving a talk to a bunch of small city mayors and their CIOs, and they were all talking about the open data piece. And I finally stopped, and I said, you know, it really surprises me that that's what you guys are talking about, because the piece that really should be exciting to you is the open source piece. Because when I talk to all these small-town mayors, you know, across America and Canada, the thing that strikes me is they're all buying the exact same programs, the exact same code over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, it's not like you all have radically different needs. You know, you all need to manage property. You all have some basic HR needs. You know, you all need to have some sort of ticketing system for, you know, police tickets and also for potholes and those types of things. Basically, your needs are pretty similar, and yet you're all paying either a company to create software for you or some software programmer to code it up in some customized version that you just use alone. And I said, wouldn't it be so much better if 5 or 6 or 7 of you banded together and hired someone to create it, made it open source, and it would be made available for everybody for free? And that's the idea of Civic Commons, is that cities should come together and either share software they've already created so others can use it for free, or they should collectively pay to have it created so they can share it among themselves for free, and find competitive people to kind of provide support for it.
And this is important because it all of a sudden allows that sharing to take place. All of a sudden, you're not building the wheel over and over and over again.
That's exactly right. You know, when you can go online and say, well, you know, we really need a software program. You know, right now we're using a software program that manages the zonings in a city. And, you know, our stuff's really quite old. It's running on some very old equipment. We need to do something new. You could go and buy something outright, but with a website like Civic Commons, you might go on and say, wow, well, the city of Portland has actually created this software. They made it open source, and we can download and use it for free tomorrow. More likely what you're going to say is we can download it and we can hire someone to help us implement it, but the cost of doing that could be so, like, that they will be radically lower than buying it outright.
So you talk to a lot of folks all around the world, and particularly government folks. And what do you tell them? For a long time, my biggest push was go do it. Just do it. Get started. Because a lot of folks were very, very nervous. My sense is we're a little bit past that. But what is your recommendation to folks that are now a couple years into the Gov 2.0 world?
So there's a couple of things. I think I do want to encourage people to just go do it. You know, that is the right attitude, because in part, when you just go do it, you will very quickly find out what the challenges are, and it'll force you to get very real very quickly on what you're going to do to solve those challenges. But I do want to encourage people to be strategic. So, you know, around open data, I think you should go do it, but you want to know exactly why you're doing it. Like, if you're just trying to open things up so the public can see stuff, that's great, but you should understand that, you know, resources to do that mission are always going to be a little bit constrained because, as you had mentioned, Chris, earlier, you know, compliance is always just going to be compliance and people are going to do what they have to do, but they're going to do the bare minimum.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a much more strategic vision, like if we open up our data, we think we can break the hold that vendors have on us and radically alter the way we do procurement and save millions and millions of dollars. Well, that's a very different angle on looking at open data, and I think it's the right one, but I think only a very, very few cities are actually there right now. So what's the strategic long-term view that you're taking, and how is that going to shape your program delivery? In the open source space, you know, here the real big problem is those actually most cities aren't allowed to procure open source software.
Hmm.
They have policies in place which say things like, you know, if any of your employees actually create software code, the city has to own that code. And of course, that runs counter to the GPL and the open source license. Other cities, you know, big cities, this is going to be really embarrassing. I run into a lot of big cities that don't actually know how to pay very, very small sums of money to procure something. You know, their notion of procurement is, you know, if they're buying something and they're a big city, you know, they're in New York, it's got to be big and expensive. And the idea of buying, like, even a $100,000 license for software, it's too small for them. They actually don't even know how to deal with it.
And almost in a way, they discount it because it's not expensive enough. Things that solve big problems need to be big and expensive. It almost doesn't end up on their radar.
Exactly. So what we end up having is we have a bunch of players who aren't looking at what the disruptive innovators are going to be that could radically reduce the cost of running software, and instead are just focused on kind of the traditional safe options.
Hmm. It's a remarkable time to be in government. We're talking U.S., but you're in Canada, but all around the world, Australia really pushing the boundaries. Remarkable time to be doing this, isn't it?
It is. I mean, the thing that Gov 2.0 that I saw that really excited me was also the number of international projects. You know, up here in Vancouver, I think we're really pushing the envelope on what's going on. We've got a great community of people who are doing interesting things with open data. Over in Australia, I was floored to see that they have an incredible project with the archives, where they put a ton of information up on the archives. They've digitized it, so they've done the kind of the language text recognition, but it created a ton of errors. So they created almost like a Wikipedia type approach, where they said if you see an error, you can edit it. You can edit this document to make the word right. And they've had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people spend, you know, volunteer time editing basically the history of Australia to fix typos. That's a task that would have cost the government millions. And in fact, they would never have done it. And so now this hugely important historical and cultural artifact is available to Australians in a digital format. And that's almost invaluable.
I think one of my, still one of my favorite quotes, the head of the recovery board was, I was talking to him about how does this recovery stuff, how does this transparency stuff, you know, they're on the cutting edge of this. And he said, if you're getting into transparency, you can't easily get embarrassed. You need to put embarrassment aside. You're going to, in fact, you can almost assume you're going to be embarrassed by something. And you really have to get over that to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, I think for a long time, you know, this is a fairly crude and unattractive analogy, but, you know, for a very long time, we've had pretty fat and flabby institutions, and not because, you know, I think government is somehow worse than other organizations, but because you know, there's a lot of fat and flab in the Fortune 500 as well.
Yeah.
It's just that it's been under kind of underneath the suit or underneath the trench coat. And now all of a sudden, you know, we're taking those coats off and we're kind of seeing people in their bathing suits for the first time. And it's
yeah, baby.
And so there's going to be a little time. But what I think is impressive, there's a lot of organizations that, you know, they're doing a lot of sit-ups and a lot of bench presses and working really hard to make themselves more fit. And it's going to take a while for them to get there. But what we got to be doing is not simply saying, you know, yelling at people, you're still too fat. Instead, what we're going to be saying is, hey, you know, those exercises are great. You should keep doing those and let me help you. And then here's a bunch more that you could be doing that are going to help you as well.
And allow people to make mistakes. There are going to be mistakes made. We have to just tolerate that and in fact, learn from that. Everyone needs to learn. And good leaders, it seems to me, are the ones who creates an umbrella, mitigate the risk, do it smartly, but also allow people to do things that may not, you know, may end up not working quite the way they thought.
You know, this fusion of the kind of San Francisco culture with the Washington culture is the part that really excites me. I mean, there are a lot of things about both cultures that I'm not always certain that I like. But, you know, two kind of core pillars of what I think has helped make America great is the first is, you know, Americans firmly believe that the sovereignty of their country lies with the people. Mm. It doesn't rely in some sovereign or in some person. It really lies in the people. And so there's an expectation in America that citizens have access to their government at almost every level. And that's the part of the Washington D.C. culture that I think is invaluable in this moment. And the part of the San Francisco culture that I think is so invaluable is this, you know, we're out in the West, we're going to do lots of crazy things and we're going to fail a lot. But, you know, every time you fail, you know, here we're going to pick you back up, put you back on your feet, and you're going to go and do it again. And the fact that those two things are coming together is, I think, what's driving that kind of open government and Gover 2.0 movement, both in the United States and around the world. And it's those two cultures coming together. It's kind of the two best parts of America right now that I think are trying to learn to dance together.
I'll tell you, he's dashing, so you wouldn't mind seeing him in his bathing suit. But I'm not getting in my bathing suit anytime soon in front of a large group of folks. But anything I didn't ask you about that I should have?
At the moment, I'm just...
There you go. I made him speechless. There you go.
I'm blushing, but you can't see me because I'm on the radio. I am blushing. No, the only thing is, you know, if you're out there and you're thinking about this stuff, the biggest part of this transformation is we got to start thinking about data and information in government as a strategic asset,
yeah,
and not as some byproduct of what we normally do. And when I look at the cities, when I look at the governments that really get it, that's what they're doing. They see their information they're gathering as a strategic asset, and they're using it to become more effective and more efficient and look more buff in that bathing suit.
And the folks who get this, and it's almost, it goes against the grain, but in the end, information is power, but the real power from that information comes in the sharing of it. And that's the miraculous thing that we're seeing is the power of that shared information.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.